עוד פעם, אני אדבר באנגלית, אז אם מישהו בכל זאת רוצה תרגום, תגידי, זה אפשרי. שמעתם כבר שיחה באנגלית וזה, אוי לא, עוד פעם. אז אפשר to change your mind. The title of the talk is Loving Our Demons. Lahov et hashedim shelanu. עוד שבועיים אני נוסע לשוויצריה למפגש, a meeting in Switzerland with crazy friend of mine who's actually a psychiatrist. Strange the way psychiatrists always seem to be just a little bit off. But he's very much a new age character with an Indian guru, and he's got this incredible kind of farm, ashram in the mountains, in the Alps, ecological palace kind of, so I'd really love to go there. And he's having a meeting of spiritual teachers and leaders and so on from all over the world, of all kinds. Shaman from Peru and shamans from Mongolia and Buddhists from New York and Buddhists from Israel and whoever, from Sufis from Turkey, and we're all gathering together. But his language, when advertising this event, makes something in my back go a little bit ugh, because the language is, without shame, very new age. And it's full of words with capital letters, like the source, with a big S, the one, with a big O, the ultimate, with a big U. And invoking means, you know, recruiting the, anyway, sort of New Age God language. And coming from a Buddhist place, this is a little bit like, because they're sandpaper for me, Niyar Sukhit. I think there is a good reason for this, and I think I say this story because it's important for us. When the Buddha was enlightened, he kind of got up out of his seat under the banyan tree and he went out in the street and he met somebody and he says, I am the ultimate, I am the perfect, I have realized the totality and me are one thing. And the person he met just went, he's cuckoo. And immediately after, he changed his teaching, and I think asked the question, if we're all fundamentally, basically free, then why don't we experience it? The reason is the obstacles, the machsomim, the coverings. And therefore we need to work on the coverings rather than talk about the God, the ultimate. Because the fundamental statement is, when the coverings are removed, then the ultimate will appear by itself. And it's not something that you need to talk about, make, because you're making, and through the whole Buddhist tradition this is quite strong. The language of totality is not a language that you find. I know there's 108 words for enlightenment, but the language that the Buddha kept saying, no need to say that I am all, or there is all, or all is there, or we are all, or we don't need that language because it's creating a kind of a thingness where there is no thing. And he said, much more interesting, let's get down to practice and say, how is it, what do we need to do? What tools do we need to remove the obstacles? When the obstacles are removed, the totality will shine by itself, and there's no words needed, and there's no status for it at all. It just is there. And that's important. So because of that, he came with the Four Noble Truths, which is exactly that. Namely, the first truth, the truth that suffering is part of the nature of experience. It's not in the world. Suffering is not in life. In the world is not suffering. The world is just the world. But our experience of it, when we meet the world, suffering will be there as part of that meeting. For all beings, whether there is an ant or an elephant or a human being, there will be suffering in that meeting with reality, with the world, somewhere. We can't avoid it. And the second truth is, the reason for it is attachment. Herzuyot, attachment. We hold on to things. Especially, as we heard from Simi and actually also myself last few days, survival. Busyness with survival, comfort, etc., is the attachment. But this is a very positive thing, because it means that there's a reason for our suffering. It's not suffering inherent. It's suffering because of. And if the because of goes, the suffering goes. And therefore, the third noble truth of the freedom from suffering, the awakening, the total freedom, is not an unbelievable God world. It's the third noble truth. It's a truth of things. Just like there is suffering in the meeting with the world, so there is liberation. So it's actually a very positive message. It's not an impossible thing. It's not something beyond. And there's a way to it. The fourth noble truth. So, coming down to earth, we are experiencing, in a way, the four noble truths right in this retreat. In fact, you could say, in every moment in this retreat. In every moment we are experiencing difficulty. Someone said it very beautifully in one of the groups, that he felt pain was engraved, charut, engraved in the heart. And yes, we have suffering written in to our a biography, to our memory, to our all the scars, tzalakot, all the scars we've accumulated on the way, they are there. And the result is sipuk, dissatisfaction. We cannot be totally free of suffering. And so what happens is, in the retreat, we sit down, we're actually quiet, we mind our own business, not hurting anybody, and boom, up comes this pain, that pain, emotional pain, historical pain, wounds that I've had, voices in the mind, my fears, my difficulties, they come at night, my body is hurting, my memory, my mind is going crazy. And it's a little bit, because the water is still, we give space. A retreat is specially for exposing our suffering. That's much more important to see our suffering than just to have business as usual, as if it doesn't exist, and cover it over again. Then we're not in the territory of Four Noble Truths. We're just in the territory of automatic pilot, tayas automati surviving. So it's good that these things come up. It's like still water. We see a pool where the meditation is like still water, and so we see the mud under the water, the bots. If we don't have still, the water is not still, we just see waves. We don't see underneath. So this, the retreat is giving a chance for the suffering to come up, because otherwise we have no material to work with. Ein lanu choma. There's nothing to work with. We just on automat. So it's okay in the stillness of the retreat for the pain to be seen, and now we have something to work with non-attachment and freedom. And and it's especially in this retreat, there's an extra issue. Whenever someone tells you to love, you're quite likely to say, "What the hell?" and start getting angry and fed up. "I don't love. This is all bullshit. My heart isn't like that. It's not made of sukkariyot and saccharin. I don't have a saccharin heart. My heart's full of real life, anger, fear, dramas, you know." So, and they come up. They're there. So we've got an extra problem. And we do meet in this retreat specifically. We do tend to meet more our vulnerability, pagiyut shelanu. In the metta retreat, actually the vulnerability comes up more easily, and we feel more vulnerable. And quite a few of you have expressed fear, and I think it's okay to feel primal fear. That means existential fear, pachad kiyumi, because we all have it. It's part of our nature as being the struggle of living. And so fear arises. And in a situation like a retreat, which is a retreat, don't forget, is like chamama, ma'abada. It's a hothouse. We're raising stuff. We're sitting here kind of cooking things. So the things are going to come up. And primal fear is very, very common in this situation, to meet our fears and our concerns. Because, as the Buddha said, really, in the end, we don't have a protector. There is no one actually, no protection in life. It's an illusion to think that we have a protection. There's a nice cover. We can have a house, a good car, a nice healthy body. But what can happen tomorrow with all of that? And there isn't really a protector. So we feel that underneath, even though we spend a lot of time and energy trying to protect ourselves and having a kind of comfort zone around us. And it comes up, this truth, it's a truth. The truth emerges. It's okay, the truth comes up. When in a Vipassana retreat, we have more tools to actually dissolve difficulty, kind of a bit more built. In the Vipassana retreat, we pay more attention to letting things go, letting things be. We are becoming, we use awareness, but we have a kind of a lightning conductor, Barak, Colette Barak. It goes, the difficulties and the pains and the dramas that we feel in the mind and in the heart, they actually, we've got quite good mechanisms to work with them. Mechanisms of anicca, we see that they pass by, we see that they're not really belonging to us, we see that the big stories that are going around our mind are actually made of nothing. And that's a very strong practice to undo the suffering, and to become non-attached to the suffering. And we meet our biography in a Vipassana retreat, and there's lots of encouragement to kind of be with the shape of who we are as we are. Let things be themselves. I'd like to have a piece in my book which says this quite well, which I just like this piece. So I'm going to ask Thomas to read it. It's just about the process.
אני גר באזור בו צומחים עלי עצי זית רבים. הם בעלי אופי אקספרסיבי להדהים, המראה בבירור את כל מה שקרה להם. ענף שנחרט, כיווני האור והרוח ביחס לעץ, מחסור במים, כל אלה באים לידי ביטוי בגופו של העץ, בפני הגזע, בכיוון צמיחתו, בנשירת העלים. צורת העץ היא הזיכרון שלו, הסנקרות שלו, התגובה לנסיבות. העץ לא סובל מכך. זהו הטבע. וכך גם אין שום סיבה שהזיכרונות יהוו בעיה עבורנו. גם אנחנו מעוצבות ונבנות בידי החיים. אנחנו מקבלות גוף, והוא מתפתח ומשתנה באופן דינמי, בהתאם לתנאים. אנחנו מגיעות אל כל רגע כפי שאנחנו. העולם מופיע מולנו ופוגש אותנו כפי שהוא. וכל שעלינו לעשות הוא להבחין בצורתם של הדברים ולהניח להם להיות עצמם. סיפורים הם רק סיפורים. נרטיבים הם רק נרטיבים. מה שמתהווה הוא רק מה שמתהווה. אם נרפה וניתן לזרם החיים לשאת אותנו, הפצעים ייעלמו, המקומות המצולקים יתרקחו, והחיים ישוב ויזרום דרכם. כך נוכל לצאת מכלא האתמול לגן ההווה. חוויה קשה יכולה להופיע כמו אורח גס רוח בביתנו ולגרום לנו לבכות. אך ברגע הבא נתחיל לפתע לצחוק והאורח ייעלם.
So we're still practicing here in this sense of being soft and kind and allowing our shape, our life, to be what it is. We're still practicing this. We're still practicing mindfulness, awareness, and being with what is. But the additional element in this retreat is a metta retreat, and it's a bit of a high risk, as I was joking to Simi today, it's kind of high risk retreat. It's a little bit like jumping on a galloping horse. You know, you can fall off, but we're galloping here. The Vipassana is there, but there's less grounding, there's less equanimity, there's less kind of lightning, as I say, like Colette Barak. And what's happened is the suggestions of love arise, the teachings on love arise, and we have to deal with them. And very often the heart is like a galloping horse. It's uncontrollable. It's wild. And the retreat is a bit wild. And when the heart is, for example, told to love, and instead their fears arise, it's because the heart is uncontrollable. We're not in the business. We can't control the heart. The heart is controlling itself and controlling us. And so when reactivity comes, the heart reacts, for example, with anger. A nice image that I remember from my retreats with Goenka was that this kind of movement is like drops of cool water that are dropped onto a hot plate. So what happens is when the drop of water touches the hot plate, there is, it reacts. It's suddenly, so words of love or practice of love that touch the heart, and the heart reacts, boom, and it can be with anger or fear or worry or all kinds of dramas. But then slowly, slowly, it settles down and the heart cools down. And so the practice, if we continue, there will be a change with the heart being less reactive. And I was thinking about this the other, like a couple of weeks ago, I took one of my granddaughters rafting in the Golan, and we were on the raft, you know, it was going over the rocks and it was a bit crazy, and oh, that's a metta retreat. That's the metta retreat's going to happen in a couple of weeks. It's important to understand that the Dharma teaching is inherently kind. That the Dharma teaching is not in the business of giving ourselves a hard time. The word for attachment is upadana, and the upadana means feeding. So when the model of the nutritional model is very important in the Dharma. So when we talk about kindness, non-struggle, although we may have in our memory stories of heroic Zen monks sitting on mountains, but you know, we may have all of that. But there is in the Dharma the understanding, and I think the Buddha reacted against his own first teachers that were talked about heroic practice when he developed a more middle way, Shvila Zahav. So it's really a question of not feeding the problems rather than fighting them, and being kind and being nutrition to the, giving nutrition, feeding the goodness, feeding the harmony, feeding the awakening, feeding the love, and not feeding the attachment, the things that give us suffering, rather than fighting. This model is in the Four Noble Truths. It's inherent in the practice. It's not something that we're trying to do kind of nice and soft. It is really the basis of the Dharma practice. And I do like the story I heard from Yonatan some time back. Maybe you know it, but I'll just say it briefly, about a demon that arrived in a king went away from his palace, and a demon arrived and sat on the chair of the king, on the throne. And the court began to shout at him, "You stinky, horrible demon, get off!" And every time they shouted at him, he got bigger. "And you get off, you stinky, horrible monster, get, this is the king's seat, go away!" Got bigger. "Go away, get off!" And he was bigger and bigger and filling the whole palace. And eventually the king arrived, and the king said to him, "Ah, hi, welcome." He got a little smaller. "Come and have a cup of tea," a little smaller. "How are you doing these days?" A little smaller. You're okay, you're a friend of mine, aren't you?" Smaller. So we need to kiss our demons. In the mythology, the folk mythology is full of this, how the hero kisses the frog and the frog becomes a prince. How the hero kisses the old, ugly old lady and she turns into the princess. We need to kiss our demons and be kind to our demons. I like the quote from Rilke, who said, "The world is not against us. All our terrors, all our demons are actually princesses that just want our love." So more than that, if we kiss our demons, which is our fears, our issues, our angers, our shame and blame, our guilt, loops in the mind. So if we kiss our demons, they actually can begin to serve us. When the heart is purified, we find it becomes a huge power. The heart is a huge power. We don't use that power for our liberation because the heart is such a cacophonia. It's all the time responding, reacting, jumping around, and it's just doing it like a wild child. But as soon as we, in a way, hold it, kiss the demon, it becomes our servant or our friend. And the power of the heart can be recruited. There's a story I want to tell, which I tell at every single Metta retreat over the years. Some of you who have been on Metta retreats with us before know this story, but I just think it's so important as a story, a true story. We were teaching a retreat at Kibbutz in Baal many years ago, and there was a lady there with cancer, quite advanced stage. And Marcia Rose was teaching a Metta retreat. And I talked with her, and she said, "It's just a disaster. What's coming up for me is just anger and anger. Why I have this disease, and why me? And it's just, my life has been such a waste, and I feel so bad and just full of anger." And but all the time she was saying this, there was something in the eyes that said something different, a kind of light in the eyes. And so I was letting her carry on. And then she said, after all of this complaint and pain she was expressing, she said, "But I went up yesterday on the top of the hill, and I had a few moments, maybe a few minutes, which I would call unconditional love. It was total, it was unconditional, it was absolute. It stayed with me for some time, and I feel because of this I could die happy." It's such a strong story that I have to tell it every time. The power of the heart is huge. So we're in the middle of mind and heart. In fact, the word citta, which is the third foundation of mindfulness, is mind-heart. And the mind and the heart, we do need to kind of get a little clearer about this. The mind and the heart are in dialogue all the time. But what tends to drive us and drive the mind is the heart. And the heart is really where a lot of our practice is anyway. Whatever we practice, wherever we, however we practice spiritually, the heart is really the center. The heart is like the sun, to use an Eastern image. The heart is like the sun, and the mind is like the moon. The mind receives the light from the sun of the heart and is lit up by the heart. The heart is the driver, is in the driving seat. The mind is a clever servant, does what we ask it to do. But the heart is driving the mind. And awakening really happens in the heart. It doesn't actually happen so much in the mind. We can't think our way to awakening. Awakening is not a thought. The third noble truth, nirvana, clarity, awakening, release, is not a thought. It's not in the thinking mind at all. It's not entirely in the heart either, but the heart is closer to it. And if we, just now I want to invite you, when you reflect on moments of awakening that you know in your own life, it's always this wow, or aha, or oh, like, or tears of joy. All of those are not thoughts. The wow is not a thought. It comes from somewhere else. And so just be aware that the heart world is close to the power of awakening. And in the same way as Vipassana, the heart world can take us beyond the self, and sometimes beyond the self more easily. The Vipassana world, or the mindfulness world, will take us beyond selfing, and that's its liberation, that's its a movement to freedom. Instead of attachment to my story, the freedom to be within my story, just like the piece that Toma read just now. But the heart does it as well. And maybe even easier, sometimes we feel the heart connection with the world takes us out of ourselves more easily. We're walking down the path and we feel, oh, there's a tree, and I and the tree are one, and that I am the earth, I'm walking on the earth, and we're together. And the sky above, and the leaves, and the animals, and my feet, and the mind, and the heart, and all this being, and other people around, and all of a sudden we're not entirely in our own story, and the heart has done it. So the heart can really lead us there and bring us to a shift in the personality. It's not something light. We shift the personality, ishiyuchalanu. Movement happens on that level. We're not the same people. Using the phrases, as I said yesterday, is an action. The phrase is an action. It's doing something. Sometimes we need that action, because in a short retreat, we need something strong. And the heart, the cacophony of the heart, needs something strong. And so we use the phrases. And the phrases, of course, not only for the retreat, but in our daily life, they can quickly and radically shift the way we look at everything. You get on a bus, and it just needs that one phrase to the bus driver in Tel Aviv. May you be happy. Everything changed. The whole atmosphere. Maybe the bus driver is the same. I'm not saying it will change the bus driver, but it will change you. You will look at the bus driver who's grumpy and upset and angry with you for some reason. All the passengers, all the people in the bank, all the people in Bituch Lumi, or I don't know, your partners, or your grandchildren, or your neighbor. Just one time, may you be happy. Or the police that stop you. Happened to me more than once. happened to me in Akko. I think I also said this story some time back, so excuse me if you heard it before. But it did happen to me that I got arrested, stopped in the car because I was using mobile phone. And the police said, okay, doch. And I just smiled. I just remembered, you know, be happy. And I smiled at the policeman, be happy. And he gave me the doch. And I said, you know what? This cannot ruin my day. It cannot, and neither can you. And I hope you have a really good day, and I'm going to have a really good day. Never mind this, doch. And he said, really? Are you sure you're going to say this? Because do you realize it's 1,000 shekels? I said, even it's 1,000 shekel, it will not spoil my day. And he laughed and I laughed, and that was, then I went on my way. But it's just the way, you know, because the phrases are so strong and clear, they shift immediately, they're strong, they like a boom, change the view completely from struggle to friendliness. But in the old original practice, of the very earliest Buddhist practice, they didn't use phrases. They used just the sense of the heart as vibration, as tether. The heart, opening the heart and spreading the energy of love as a kind of vibration. And I'll read to you how, again and again and again in the traditional text, it's written like this. Again, a monk stays, abides, spreading one quarter with a mind full of loving kindness. And the second quarter means of Shloshmot Shishim Ma'alot, second quarter, and the third quarter, and the fourth quarter, and above, and below, and around, and everywhere, and to all beings just and to himself, he stays spreading the total world around with a mind full of loving kindness, abundant, meaning lots, full, high, immeasurable. Talked about that yesterday. It has no measure. Love has no measure. Without any anger or hostility or ill will. That's how they used to practice in ancient times. And you can feel that now as part of the practice, just like I mentioned with a walking meditation. It's the empathic closeness to life. It's the heart vibrating with the vibration of all beings, with the vibration of all. The tree is as a vibration. Our empathy with each other, our empathy, because we are the same as the ants that are crawling through the grass and the birds in the sky. They are like us. They are living and dying, feeling, suffering, joy, just like us. The whole world is really part of one, is one. And the heart helps us to joining the world, and therefore coming out of this shell of me. The heart is the joy, is the movement of joining, of returning, of being absorbed, of closing duality. The heart is, or the love is not dual. The mind can be dualistic, me and an object, me and this thing, me and you. That's the mind. But the love doesn't have dualism. The love is all joining everything that joins the me and the world, the self and this object. The heart connects and joins, and there is no me and other anymore. So I just want to finish with a reminder that it's not entirely just the Dharma. This is fundamental spirituality. This is basic to all authentic spiritual journey. And I was impressed, strangely, that how it's written in the Shema. And the second line of Shema Yisrael says, Va'ahavta et Adonai, v'chol levavcha, uv'chol nafshecha, uv'chol m'odecha. V'ahavta, the love, is the one thing that you need to do as practicing Jew. Never mind all history, the Jewish history of million mitzvot and million things to do and tzitzit and hats, and just forget all of that for a minute and say, what is the mantra of the Jewish life? It's V'ahavta et Hashem, et Elohim, et Adonai. What is Adonai? Must be everything, totality. Cannot be a thing. It's universal. So love the universal means with all your koach, with the totality, me'odcha, with all your power. And it also goes on when you get up, when you go to sleep. That's what we say is the Buddhist teaching. Exactly what we're saying. When you get up, when you come 6:30 in the morning, when you go to sleep, practice 24 hours. It's the same. And in the Shema also, in the first Mishpat, there's a key, which is Shema. The Echad is not interesting. The Echad is a thing again. But Shema, and I think it's really close to what we're doing here. Wake up, Shema, listen. And you'll see, you'll feel, you'll know oneness. You'll know the unity. Wake up and love. And there's nothing else, really. Thank you. So we'll take a couple of minutes quiet.